Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista and transmitting from Round Mountain, California. Here we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance are brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. Today's guest, born in humble poverty in Jalisco, Mexico, cutting sugar cane, caring for over 10 cows, cleaning pig pens, selling oranges on the street by the time he was 10 years old. He helped his family by these productive means, pitching in to help feed his family. There were many gaps in his schoolings in his formative years. Rafael, or better said, Dr. Rafael Lupicerio, not beginning to learn English till he was 17. Dr. Lupicerio is the oldest of seven siblings, his father, a sheep herder and a ranch foreman, and mother, who worked in the fields and canneries of Solano County. They taught him through hard work, sacrifice, and courage to seek a new life in a different country. The values to survive and grasp of the opportunities to build a future in his new home, the United States. Hard work, love, spirituality was his family's daily dose for living. Then immigration to rural Northern California, and now a well-respected physician in pulmonary and critical care medicine in Northern California. Please listen to this heartfelt story. Dr. Rafael Lupicerio, welcome to today's show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure. I've never had a doctor on the show, doctor. at least not a medical doctor. Doctor, you've lived through from rags to riches, I guess one might say. Not able to speak the English language till you're 17. As we said, humble beginning, cleaning pig pens, selling oranges, working with the family. Now you're a highly acclaimed doctor in Shasta County. That's a long step and a long gap. How would you define, you know, your success or your life at this point?
Well, I feel I've been blessed, and I'm also fortunate. I had the humble beginnings, and I'm still humble, mm-hmm. though I make better living, and most important, I do what I like, do what I love, which mm-hmm. is take care of people and respiratory diseases. Mm-hmm. But mainly, I was very fortunate to have a caring family that basically guided me through and showed me the ropes in a way, hard work, mm-hmm. faith in yourself, believing in yourself, mm-hmm. and not being scared, you know, mm-hmm. of working hard and accomplishing things. Mm-hmm.
Well, your father, both your parents, had to obviously set the course for yes. you and your siblings. Tell us about your earliest recollections as a child in Mexico doing these duties to keep the family or contribute to the family's overall existence.
Well, my father's always been a very smart man, very hardworking. Always try to get better, do better for mm-hmm. himself. He worked for someone else because he had no choice, and then he started raising his own cattle, you know, one cow at a time. And I also remember that he, at one point, I don't know exactly the details, but he actually was looking at coming to the States, and he only went to school for 3 years in his lifetime.
Really?
Yeah. And I remember,
were those the graduate years or the beginning
no,
years?
No, the beginning years, only to the third grade. And it was only,
my goodness.
Because back in those times, they will take the kids out to help plant corn mm-hmm. and so on. So they only went to school when there was nothing to do in between duties that I had to do to raise the crops and care for the animals. Mm-hmm. So he only had three seasons. I'm not sure exactly how long, but it wasn't even three full years. So he learned how to read and write and mm-hmm. and some basic math. And but I remember that, it's probably around five, six, vaguely remember, that he was going to come to the States. There was an opportunity for him to go to Ohio at the time. Mm-hmm. There were some relatives that already lived there. And he decided to learn English. And he learned basic English through a correspondence course.
Amazing. And this was about what year?
Oh, probably mid-60s.
So he wasn't on the internet getting downloaded.
No. It was a big one of those big records that the Alone plays.
My goodness sakes.
And I remember he was at night repeating these words that I had no idea. In fact, we used to imitate him, you know, making the sounds. I'm the oldest of seven kids, so.
Right.
So I think that's the kind of thing that I grew up seeing. You know, mm-hmm. he never told me do this or do that, but basically by looking at him and seeing what he did. And obviously my mom was always taking care of the family.
Sure.
You know, I was working all day pretty right. much, you know, mm-hmm. from bringing water to cooking to anything, taking care of the kids. So
it's an amazing story. You hold three medical specialties.
Yeah.
One is critical care, and the other two are
so internal medicine and pulmonary medicine.
Uh-huh.
So
do you specialize in one of these more than the other?
Well, lately I've been doing mostly more pulmonary medicine because of the need here. There's only
what does that really encompass?
Well, mainly I deal with the lungs, uh-huh. respiratory medical problems.
Uh-huh.
Anything from cancer to emphysema, COPD, asthma, pulmonary fibrosis, respiratory problems. So people have a hard time cough, you mm-hmm. know. But over the last, I'll say, 5 years or so, I was the only pulmonologist in Shasta County.
I understand that. Yeah. That it's very difficult to see it, Paul. Sometimes.
Now, there are two more, but the other two that I know in town, they do more of a specialty clinic. They mm-hmm. they were not doing the full breadth of a pulmonary medicine. Mm-hmm. And now, over the last 3 months, I got a partner, mm-hmm. you know, a physician. I know the pulmonologist that is working with me, mm-hmm. Dr. Omar. Very, very, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Very smart lady.
So dealing in this pulmonary area, I'm assuming that most of your patients are older patients, or maybe
yes.
a lot of veterans. And,
indeed,
right.
Indeed.
And I would guess that the smoking is a leading step to
yes, indeed, uh-huh. indeed. And unfortunately, if you look at the statistics of percentage of smokers in the country, and California has the second lowest percentage of smokers. Utah.
Lowest?
Yes. Utah's number one with about 8% of people smoking in Utah.
Uh-huh.
And about 10 to 12% in California.
Uh-huh.
But if you break it down by county, any of the north state counties, people smoke a lot. It's about the same as Kentucky and Tennessee, which is about 30 to 35% of the people smoke.
Really? That's a very interesting statistic.
Indeed. And unfortunately, I diagnose a very large amount of cancers around here.
Uh-huh.
Probably more than most doctors, most pulmonologists in the state.
Really?
Yes, indeed. I don't know the specific numbers, but I can tell you that we have some innovative, cutting-edge diagnostic procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have these specialized bronchoscopes in here. Mm-hmm. It's actually donated. The money was donated by a local foundation to get this bronchoscopes.
Uh-huh.
And we looked at all the statistics, and Shasta County, all these counties here have a very large proportion of lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And by with these new procedures, we can actually diagnose people earlier.
Before it manifests?
Well, no. Uh-huh. No, the tumor has to be present. But the problem is that if you look at the survival of lung cancer kills more people than all the other cancers together.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, lung cancer kills more people than any other. If you combine colon cancer, prostate cancer, mm-hmm. breast cancer, lung cancer kills more people than all of them together. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I assume that most of that would be preventable.
Isn't that indeed. Right? Uh-huh. Smoking.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I noticed in your background that I was fortunate to see that one of the things that your parents taught you was not to smoke.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times has to do with what you see. You know, mm-hmm. my parents never smoked. None of them smoked. Mm-hmm. Not either one of them did not smoke. And obviously, it's not something that I care for. I mean, it just never. You know, I tried it once and I got dizzy. In fact, the only time I remember trying in a tobacco, I was actually working at a cattle ranch in Dixon. And I noticed that one of the guys that we were actually driving some cattle and we were actually riding horses. And I noticed someone pull out one of those smokeless tobacco you put under your tongue.
You're chewing tobacco or something?
Well, I tried it and I get so dizzy, I almost fell off the horses. Who would want to do this, you know? And that was the end of it. I never tried that anymore.
It.
Yeah.
What drew you to work in this area of pulmonary disease? I mean, what you know, we're going to go back to the show as to how you thought about being a doctor. Yeah. But at this point, what was the trigger to get you to specialize in this sort of care?
Pulmonary medicine. Uh-huh. Well, I actually worked as an internist. My when I was in medical school, I did a lot of research in cardiology, and that's mm-hmm. what I was going to go into. Mm-hmm. But then when I did, in order to become a lung specialist, you have to do a specialty on internal medicine first. Mm-hmm. And then you can go into the cardiology, nephrology, pulmonary medicine, rheumatology, endocrinology, all infectious diseases. So I asked my wife, hey, I want to do this. And she says, well, you know, we got three kids, you know, so I decided to work for a while. Mm-hmm. And I worked as an internist, and I recognized that I actually enjoy taking care of people that had chronic diseases. Mm-hmm. And also enjoy the intensive care unit. Back then I was younger, so I had more energy. And I decided to go back and do a subspecialty in pulmonary and critical care medicine. Mm-hmm. And so when I finished my fellowship, I started looking around as to where to go. And this area... obviously was needed, and my wife actually grew up more northern here up in Siskiyou County. Mm-hmm. So we decided to come up here, and we decided to give it a try, and we love it. We're still here. That was 17 years ago.
Well, the community is very happy to have you here.
Well, yeah,
for
it's,
sure.
It's a mutual feeling.
You know, the environment. Is when we moved first up to Shasta County, we read that the environment was not the best environment for asthma and those sort of things because of maybe the rice burns and so forth and so on. Is there, in a more current basis, is there a factor in these patients that you raise have anything to do with our environment?
You know, it's possible, but the main thing is smoking.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's no really... the environment can have a factor, but I looked up at some of the, for lung cancer, it's really smoking. Mm-hmm. For respiratory diseases, yes, some of the environment can be a problem because this is a basin. First, in the summertime, it's not very clean.
Right.
Because there's a lot of smoke that sits here. That will be a factor for respiratory problems, like making or having the COPD become worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because that pertains to the bronchioles closing down on a person. So any kind of irritant that gets into the bronchi or the windpipes that can make that worse or create more an inflammatory process, it will have it will have an effect.
Right. Doctor, we're approaching our first break, but you know, a question that you can answer to our listeners is, you know, the actual treatment process and the success rate and that sort of thing. So when we come back, we're going to ask you to address that question.
Sure. Be happy to.
This is welcome to... Doctor, after the break, we're going to ask you to tell our listeners just your procedure for treating the patients that you do. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 listener-supported radio. And I'm Henry Cuenca, and my guest today is Dr. Rafael. I've been calling you Lupercio, but it's Lupercio.
Lupercio, yes.
Okay, and sorry for that.
It's okay, no big deal.
So before the break, we talked about, you know, the patients you treat and the environment and smoking and so forth. Tell us about the actual treatment that you give to your patients, the profile of your patients.
Well, obviously, each disease requires a different treatment. For instance, for abnormal CT scan or CAT scan, chest mass, mainly what I do is diagnose a patient, and either by me doing a procedure, or by sending the patient to a surgeon or interventional radiologist, someone that can put a needle from outside. Once we make the diagnosis, then I do the characterize the patient as to what will be the best treatment for the patient, chemo, radiation, or surgery, based upon their overall health profile and functionality, and also where the tumor is. Obviously, for diseases like COPD, emphysema, asthma, then the or pulmonary fibrosis or cough, then it depends on what's causing the problem. Then the treatment is tailored to what's causing the problem. However, for most, like COPD, emphysema, pulmonary fibrosis, and even cough, the main thing is to stop smoking.
Is that your biggest challenge?
It is a big challenge.
So even though patients have this cancerous condition, smoking still is an enormous challenge for them.
It's a big challenge. One of the main issues is that nicotine gets into the brain and makes the brain produce a molecule that gives people pleasure. Mm-hmm. And even though most people don't recognize it, if they don't have the smoke, they miss it because the brain will remind them. It's like programming a computer. The brain is the same way. So if a person doesn't have the nicotine, they miss it. They have these rituals that they do all the time. They get stressed out. They want the nicotine. And it's extremely difficult to give it up if people don't recognize that. They have to endure a little bit of suffering to quit smoking. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that will...
There's no pill that they can take then.
Well, there's a pill, but it's not the end. It's not the answer because eventually you have to go through the process. And very easy to get back again because most people quit and then they get stressed out. Oh, I'm just going to have one until whatever is going on.
Well, I was a prior smoker, and I know how difficult it is to smoke. It's very, very difficult.
Yes. But for other conditions, then we tailor the medications and so on to whatever condition the person's having.
What gratification do you get in your work?
Well, mainly taking care of people, mainly helping them out, you know, making them feel better. In some cases, it's just mainly educating people, making them understand, and coming up with a... sometimes people, all they need is mainly information. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know why all of a sudden they became short of breath and why they have this problem. So when we try to explain what's going on and how this happened... People feel validated. They know, okay, now I know why I'm having this problem. And also, sometimes also coming up with a plan so that the person does not get worse. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing.
Yeah. You know, somewhere I picked up, Doctor, that at one point in your work here in Reading, that you were acclaimed to be one of the top doctors in California for bedside manners. Is that? Did I read that correct, or did I?
I don't know. I do what I can. I mean, I do my best on every patient. I guarantee you that. Right. You know, and I take the same approach at everything that I do. You know, but I definitely do my best. That's for sure.
Well, you certainly do. Yeah. Doctor, let's go back to Mexico, I guess.
Sure.
And I'm very intrigued by the fact that your father had no formal education, decided to take schooling to better himself, and there were six others, siblings total,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And tell me, and you were the oldest of the
I'm
seven,
the oldest,
right?
Yes.
And so all the children participated in the had to do to keep the family going.
Yeah, we all work as a unit.
Right.
Yeah.
And what is to me just the most startling that sticks out is that all of your siblings, brothers and sisters, came to the United States and got a college degree.
Yes, they did.
That's
yeah.
Isn't that a hallmark?
It is, but at the same time, I think it's also a way to honor our parents, their sacrifice. You know, when people leave their country, they go to another place, and, you know, this is the country of opportunities. And, you know, so we all took advantage of that and decided to improve our lives and also try to, in a way, now that our parents are older, you know, we can actually help them out too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's mainly we decided, you know, we all thought that just the work ethic that we were taught, we just continue it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no, we never had any discussions about you're going to do this, you're going to do that. It's basically you just do the best at whatever you did.
And I guess that you all picked up from the things that your parents did, right?
Yes.
I mean, your
yes.
father taking a correspondence course.
Yeah.
And your father was when you moved to the United States, did you target Northern California, or was it just by random that you decided to come to Lake?
Well, my father came and to Dixon, California, and he got a job, and then he got a visa to come in as a sheep herder.
Mm-hmm.
They used to bring people from Spain, Mexico, and Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one of those, and then his boss actually sponsored him to become a permanent resident. And that's how we ended up here.
Do you remember moving to the United States?
Yeah, I was 17.
Oh, you were 17.
17,
then.
Yeah.
Also, you did not speak English up until that point, so you started English here in Northern California.
Well, in fact, from the age of 11 to the age of 17, I didn't really have any schooling because in my hometown we can only go up to the sixth grade, and then they had a junior high that was run by volunteer teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really formal, so they basically 80% of the time they didn't show up to teach. And so basically that was the education that I had. So
did you learn English?
No, nothing. They put me in the 10th grade and high school, and the first year we had five hours of English. Mm-hmm. And we went from a simple sentence like "this is a woman" to more and more complicated, you know, writing a paragraph and so on. I think one of the things that really helped me out is that when I was in elementary school in Mexico, for 2 years I had a teacher that was very obsessed about teaching Spanish grammar. And, you know, back in Mexico, you listen to the teacher because she had a stick, and she was not afraid to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bamboo stick about a half a meter long. And she was not afraid to use it. And I can tell you that she'll start teaching like a sentence and then put it up on the blackboard. And then she'll bring you up to the front of the class and ask you, "What is this?" You have to say what it was grammatically. If you didn't, she'll give you a whack.
Okay.
So I learned very quickly.
She had no choice.
She never whacked me because I was they went by alphabetical order. I was in the middle of the classroom, so I always knew the answer because I didn't want to be whacked.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell us about your mother.
Well, very typical Mexican lady, very family oriented, worked pretty much day in and day out. You know, is one of those typical mothers that
love their children.
Exactly. And they work, and we don't even know what they do until let's say we try to do it ourselves, like, oh, my God, you know, recognize how much work a woman does in a house from sun up to sundown and even more.
You know, you had said, indicated that spirituality was part of your daily living. Indeed. Could you tell us about that?
Well, growing up until we started getting married, you know, we had to pray a rosary every day in the house. I mean, we will be, even if we're on the street playing, you know, my parents will call us in and, okay, time to dinner, and then after that, rosary, and then go to bed.
You know, some of our listeners may not know what praying the rosary is, so could you share a little bit of insight for us on that?
Basically, it's a gathering, and you have, 10 sessions of...
Decades.
Decades of, what do you call the Hail Marys?
Well, that could be, right?
Hail Mary, and also, what's the other one?
The other, Our Father.
Oh, yeah. So there's in between, and there's a whole...
So you would gather each day or weekly?
Yes.
And you,
no, well, every day.
Every night,
yeah. Uh-huh. That was our... when we were little, you know, once we started growing up, everybody went their own way, but probably up until the age of 15, 16, that I remember... probably even more, because even when I came to this country, we used to play the rosary pretty much every day.
What was your first impression when you landed in the United States? The very first impression that you had?
A lot of buildings, you know, a lot of roads, very nice countryside.
Uh-huh. And that was in Dixon?
In Dixon, uh-huh. And beautiful country. And, you know, high school was a different experience. It was interesting to go into a place that you did not understand the language and so on. But at the same time, it was intriguing. And, you know, I had this yearning for learning that I learned English relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. Within a year and a half, I was actually able to communicate. And
so that put you in your sophomore year, freshman year?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then... what's interesting is that after a while, I was able to make this transition in my brain. Like when I'm speaking English, I think in English. And then when I'm talking in Spanish, I think in Spanish. And obviously, the accent's going to be something that is going to be with me until I die. Because, you know, when you learn another language after the age of 13 or so, you always have an accent. Because when we go through puberty, we lose hearing cells.
I see.
Therefore, we don't hear certain sounds, and if you don't hear it, you can't reproduce them. Yeah, but just basically.
So you have an accent. So
yeah, indeed. Yeah.
So, I guess all of you, the whole family, was still in sync with each other, and when you moved to California,
yes,
and your father became a sheep herder here. Or
he always been in cattle, always been in livestock. Uh-huh. He always been, always has had worked with some kind of livestock in different places. And obviously, we didn't have a lot of sheep in Mexico, but here in the States, that's what we learned. They also had livestock in this ranch, not in Dixon. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I read here that your first biology class, you got an F.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. And to be a medical doctor, you kind of need that.
Well, what happened is that I got to Sac State, which is where I went to college, and I took some remedial classes to catch up. You know, English, pre-English 1A, mainly the writing and the reading. The writing was a problem for me at that time. And then I thought, okay, I'm ready to take some of the real classes that I'm interested in, which is biology. But I took a class, and it turns out that the professor was Scottish. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what he was saying. And even though it was in English, but it was a Scottish English. And and I didn't realize that you can actually drop the class, so I just stuck with it. And at the end, I had no idea what I learned. Therefore, you ended up having an F. But then I regrouped, figured out what to do, and... I did well enough to get into medical school.
Did your other brothers and sisters have these kind of little bumps?
You know, I don't know for sure, but I'm sure they did.
Yeah. Yeah. Doctor, we're going to have to take another break right now, and listeners, we're going to be back in just a minute, so don't go very far. If you're just joining us, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, and I'm Henry Cuenca. And Dr. Rafael has given me the okay to call him Dr. Rafael. So, and my guest today is Dr. Rafael, and we're talking about his life starting in Mexico and ending up here in the United States and becoming a medical doctor. So, doctor, what are the biggest challenges that you've had? You know, the biggest challenges you faced when you moved to United States, California.
Well, like any other immigrant, getting used to the different environment, obviously the language. That was probably the biggest hurdle at the beginning. Once the language is under control, then you can start acclimating and assimilating into the culture. Mm-hmm. Learning also on the culture, the different way of thinking, mm-hmm. if you might want to say that. In a way, sometimes a little bit of the prejudice also it comes into play a little bit sometimes.
What was that?
Being the prejudice that sometimes you encounter. You know.
Did you find much prejudice?
I never felt it in a way, but we know it's there. Mm-hmm. You know, and but
do you still see that now?
Oh yes.
Really?
Yes. Yes. I mean, one of the things that I'm always asking: Are you Italian? Mm-hmm. And no, I'm Mexican. That's what I reply. Are you Spaniard? No, I'm Mexican. Okay, it's almost like I can't be a doctor and be a Mexican. Uh-huh. And I don't know if that's the way people meant it or how.
It's hard to say.
Hard to say, but I tell you, there's nothing wrong with any culture
of course,
at all. And any
of course not.
You know, there's nothing wrong with anybody. So I don't take offense to that, but it does bother me sometimes mm-hmm. that why can I be Mexican?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a very handsome man, and your picture is on the station website and my website. So, you made a comment once to me that that the more load that you put on a donkey, the more compelling and the quicker he moves. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, what I meant is that if you see this big load on you, you want to get to the place that you want to get to. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when you have more hardship, you accomplish more. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I kind of view that. Yeah. You know, when you have unduly things put on you, you got to work through, because there typically is a silver lining to all of these situations.
Yeah.
And you learn from the experience. There's absolutely no question about that.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, I mean, life's a learning experience. And in general, there's everything that you go through happens for a reason, and mm-hmm. you learn from it, and you get, most of the time, you're better for it mm-hmm. because of it.
I know that your family is very important to you.
Yes.
Tell us about your wife and how you met your wife.
We both were students at Sac State, and she actually grew up, was born in Klamath Falls, Oregon, from Mexican parents, too. And my father-in-law was actually used to work on the railroad around here. From he used to work from Dunsmere all the way up to Klamath Falls. And she actually, what's striking to me about her is that even though she grew up in this area, she was very embraced the Mexican culture quite a bit, from music and everything. So we met Sac State just coincidentally.
That's the way things happen.
Exactly. And we got along really well, and obviously we've been married for 32 years now.
And tell us about your children.
I have four kids, three daughters and a son. Mm-hmm. My oldest one is 31, just got married. She's an engineer, mm-hmm. civil and mechanical engineer. And then my son is a musician. He's 27, and he's got a degree in music, and he's actually getting a teaching credential and thinking about law school. I don't know which way he's
going to
go, yeah.
So he's another bright young man.
And then my third daughter is she's got a degree from Gonzaga University in chemistry.
Up in Washington.
Yes.
And, in chemistry.
Chemistry.
That was your suit, right?
Yes. She's thinking about medicine. She's still trying to decide if she's thinking about medicine. And then I have a 10-year-old in the house, mm-hmm. a little surprise baby.
And what inclination is she showing?
I don't know. She's all over the place. she likes... music, but she tells everybody she's going to be a biomedical engineer, and I don't even know.
Oh, she's using that term already.
Yes, already. I don't even know if she understands what that means. Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing. What do you see as, you know, your biggest challenge, or looking back even, what has been your life's biggest challenge?
I don't know if I have anything specific other than...
Maybe you didn't have any challenges, huh?
Well, I think everything was a challenge, but I didn't see it as such. I think sometimes, you know what they say, ignorance is bliss. You know,
I've heard that.
I had no idea what I was getting into or what I was doing. I just worked. And one thing at a time, I was able to accomplish one thing at a time. I was able to get to where I am. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been very fortunate so far in the sense that I got a good family. I've been healthy. And so far, nothing tragic has happened in my family. And that's something that I really, so I think that's why I don't feel I have any significant challenges that
I guess you just take life as it comes and do the best you can.
Indeed, but at the same time, it really hasn't been that bad. You know, I mean, I you know, thank God. You know, so far I don't have anything that that I feel like that was a huge hurdle for me to get through. No tragic.
Do you have hobbies?
Oh yeah.
What are they?
Well, I play a little bit guitar by ear, and I play soccer every when I can at the soccer park here in Reading. Basically, music, spending time with my family, and some sports. Soccer is one of the big ones. Yeah.
What would you say was the best advice that that you ever received from anybody?
Well, basically, be yourself. Mm-hmm. Work hard. Hard work pays off. Mm-hmm. Things that are worth anything require work. And pretty much it. Be honest to yourself. Don't hurt anybody. Be a good person.
Well, those sound like pretty good things.
Yeah, basic. Nothing specific, but basic.
Doctor, we have to take another break right now.
Okay.
We're going to be right back. Again, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, and I have as my guest Dr. Raphael, and we're talking about some of his life's commitments, hard work, spirituality, be honest, be yourself, and anything else to add to that?
Stay healthy. Don't do things that I will hurt your body. You know, I mean, if you get a disease that is something else, well, that's the way it happens. But
Doctor, you certainly really come across as being pretty level-headed on life. Do you have a place to draw your strength from to give you this inner dynamic of just pushing forward?
I don't think of anything in particular other than, like I said, I've been fortunate. I have a good wife, good family. My kids are doing okay. I got a good job. I love what I do.
Isn't that wonderful? And you've been practicing medicine for how long?
I graduated from medical school in '93. So, but as a lung specialist, it's been 17 years here in Reading.
Oh, that's a long time. You're a master at it. Yeah. What are your? How would you define your top two skills?
In medicine?
Whatever. Could be the guitar.
Not one.
No, what are your top two skills?
Well,
that make you. What are they?
I think my communication skills, being able to relate to people at all levels, that's probably number one. Most of my patients, when they leave the office, they understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that's because I'm able to, in a way, interpret the medical terminology into the language that they can understand. As far as technical skills, I think probably doing bronchoscopies. Probably I do a lot of them.
So a lot of what?
Bronchoscopies.
Oh, okay. Could you explain that to us?
Yeah, that's going inside the lungs to take a biopsy or to look inside the lungs. Mm-hmm. And I've probably done thousands of those.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I become really skilled at that. You know, I'm probably one of the best bronchoscopists around.
Really? Yeah. So you explain a little bit more on the detail of what you actually do.
Well, the way we do that is that, like I said, when there's a mass or some kind of tumor inside the lung, we need to get to that area. What we do is that we go through the mouth, through the vocal cords. So we go all the way inside. The bronchoscope's about 30 centimeters long, mm-hmm. probably maybe. Well, maybe 30, 40, I guess.
Is this a hospital procedure?
Yes. Uh-huh. So what we do, we basically put the patient to sleep, or not completely. The patient's still breathing on their own. But we give them medicine. They don't care what we're doing to them. And then we go inside, inspect the airway, and then take biopsies. And it's an invasive procedure, but it's not like a big surgery. Mm-hmm. The patients go home the same day. Then a couple hours, they go home. They wake up, they go home. It's like having a colonoscopy, essentially, except mm-hmm. that it's a lot more...
I've had those.
Yeah. It's different, except we're going to a different place.
And so you're a leader, certainly in this area.
Yes, indeed.
Of this.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed.
So it's very interesting just to hear you say that that you truly enjoy every day of your work. I presume you work overtime sometimes, too.
Yes, indeed. I have to be honest and say that what I don't like about medicine is all the bureaucracy.
Tell us how that affects you.
Well, I mean, the more and more requirements for instance, to order a test, you know, the insurance sometimes give you a hard time, and they don't want to approve a procedure or a test that... We know as a doctor that the patient needs, and we have to get on the phone and explain to some person that doesn't...
Not a medical person, right?
Maybe, but sometimes a doctor, but a doctor that has not seen the patient. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some insurance related to a person and so on, and that's probably not the enjoyable part of medicine, the requirement for documenting everything and wasting a lot of time writing things about the patient instead of spending time with the patient.
You know, that's very interesting. Of course, you know, I do go see doctors.
Yes.
And just as an observation, just what you're touching on, yeah. is that the doctor who, you know, to me is very cordial. I mean, yeah. I like my doctor yeah. very, very much. But the engagement doesn't seem to be there.
No.
The engagement is, how are you? And then immediately to the computer... And they're typing, computer asks me questions, and I give responses, and it goes in the computer for their files, which I guess are requirements. But what seems to me really, as a patient, seems to be lacking is that emotional interaction with a doctor, which I think personally is really very, very important. Speaking just for myself, I think it's very important.
By all means. Uh-huh. It's getting to know your patients at a personal level makes a big difference.
Uh-huh.
How the patients approach, how they're going to respond or react to different situations. Interesting, I can tell you real quick, I was doing I did a research study in Costa Rica when I was doing my fellowship.
Mm-hmm. So you went to South America?
Central America.
Oh, Central America.
Multiple times. And interesting that I met a doctor down there because I was doing a specific study on a farm, and the foreman says, hey, can my daughter come over? She's a doctor here. And so she can see the machinery they have in here. She told me she will see 200 patients in a day. She was an ER doctor.
What? Did I miss that?
200 patients a
200?
Day. 200? Yes. And I'm like, no way. She says, well, come and see me. I'll pick you up at the hotel. I'll take you so you can see how I work. It's fascinating that she actually will see 20 patients in an hour.
That's too much math for me, but that's only a couple of minutes.
But I will tell you how she did it. You know, Costa Rica has national health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow patients still wait to go to the ER in the evening instead of, you know, going to the doctor. So she had a line of patients divided by like some kind of curtain. And then she'll come in and listen to the patient. And they'll say, cold pack. The nurse was with a cart behind her, had a bag of NyQuil, Tylenol, aspirin. So the patient had a cold. That's all they got. Out. And then every now and then she'll run into a patient that had a problem. Said, oh, this patient has a pneumonia. Shot of penicillin, get an X-ray. And she kept going. The patient stayed there. And they'll come back again, see this patient. Oh, you got a pneumonia? She'll write me to the hospitalist, patient with pneumonia. That's it. In this country, we had to write a whole life history for a cold. So there's no way that an ER doctor can see that many patients.
What a contrasting way of doing things.
Indeed. You know, it was very eye-opening for me, like, wow, this is insane what we do in the States. But we had to do that in this country.
Well, that's the way.
It is.
You know,
okay. Yeah.
What an interesting that's just so fascinating
it
to
is.
Me.
It is.
The 200 patients.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't believe, but indeed, I was there for 2 hours. She probably saw 40 patients.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. And I presume that most of the patients that were there were really there for some minor situations.
Yes. They were not. Like I said, I think she saw, like, when I was there, maybe 2 or 3 people with pneumonia.
Uh huh.
That were hospitalized.
Doctor, is there anything you're afraid of?
Oh, I guess like anybody else, my family. You know, I hope they stay well all the time. Mm-hmm. I know we're going to die, but hopefully it's not going to happen soon. Till I see.
I know you're very, very proud of your children.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't be,
yeah.
You know, with their pursuits?
Well, they're good people. Uh-huh. That's the main thing.
Right.
You know, good, humble people and hardworking people. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, anything else is, you know, to me, that's the most important aspect of life. You know, being a good person, someone that is willing to leave a mark in this world by being a good person, mm-hmm. providing for yourself and everyone else that you can.
Right. Yeah. I think as society, I think we've lost some of that.
I think so. A lot of times, the grind, the money, and so on, can sometimes lead us a different way.
Right. Yeah. Do you treat? Do we have a number of homeless people in Shasta County? Do you treat at all homeless people?
My office never says no to anybody.
So you take any patient?
Any patient. And I always have done that. In fact, my group, I'm proud to say that my group, because I work with another six doctors, all of us take anybody. Mm-hmm. We don't ask for insurance.
Really?
No. We obviously bill the patients, but if someone can pay, we'll see them anyway. Our office does that. And you can ask anybody else. They don't. Doctors that have to refer patients to us, they don't have to worry about, oh, they won't take this insurance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been like that since I've been here.
Doctor, is that a unique situation with your group, or is this pretty much prevalent through other doctors' offices in the county?
I don't know, but I think there's a lot of places. Like, for instance, I find myself not being able to refer patients to other doctors because I won't take certain insurances. Mm-hmm. But our office is not like that. That's something that we pride ourselves on that we don't. And interesting enough, you know, we do well financially. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't really affected us. And I don't know, maybe we can make more money. But, okay, we make 10.
So what? Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, you know, we still pay the bills. We still get our kids to college and so on. So it's not like mm-hmm. it hasn't affected us in a severe way. But, yeah, you can ask.
Well, that's a very beautiful thing to hear from you. That, you know, I just didn't realize that this actually went on, to be really honest with you.
No, we've been doing that since we came here 17 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why I actually want to stay here. But, you know, this community, it's also very supportive. You know, like I said, there's a lot of foundations that donate money to hospitals. Like, there's a foundation called Miramontes Foundation that uh-huh. donated significant amount of money for this special bronchoscope that we have in one of the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And they donated the money, you know, mm-hmm. for the community. Mm-hmm. Some of that equipment is not even in academic centers. Like the one that I have here, they don't even have in some of the university hospitals. And we have it here.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's a hallmark.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So I want to know more about, you know, your overall insight that you've developed in your life. Has there ever been a deep-rooted insight or aha moment in your life that you saw something that led you to something else?
Well, I think having the first child, mm-hmm. that's probably one of the landmarks that I will make you change overall. You realize that your life's about to change because you're responsible for someone else. Mm-hmm. After that, you kind of get used to it. Just keep working and keep taking care of all the other ones that come. Mm-hmm. But definitely that was one of the things that marked my life. Everything else, I don't know. I mean, I just go day by day. Mm-hmm. I've experienced some unique situations with patients. I remember one in particular that this patient that I diagnosed with lung cancer, and she told me that she didn't want anything done. And
do a lot of patients tell you that?
Yes,
some do.
Yeah. Uh-huh. She was 83, and so I was on the fourth floor of a hospital, and I came out and talked to a nurse. In fact, the patient made me call her daughter right there, and then to make sure that everybody was on the same page. Mm-hmm. And I got to the parking lot, and the nurse calls me and says, "You have to listen to your patient." So she puts the phone up, and I can hear the patient screaming, "Please, Lord Jesus Christ, please come and take me. Please come and take me."
This was the patient.
A patient. And, okay. So, big deal. So I'm driving out of the parking lot. The nurse comes back again and says, "Guess what? She passed." Yeah. She passed. You know, it's funny because that was about 10 years ago, and that nurse, I see her in the hospital every now and then. Every time we look at each other, we kind of remember that.
You click into each other.
Like you know, and we talk about that very often because my father is actually a deacon the Catholic Church, and I told him the story one time, and it was one of those, like, if I hadn't experienced that myself, I would never.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's very emotional.
It is. And I don't know if it was coincidental. I don't know. Yeah. But it was very, very
profound,
yeah. Very bizarre that, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm talking to this lady, like I'm talking to you right now, and mm-hmm. literally 15 minutes later, she's dead.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
Yeah, so. Wow. And was asking for Jesus to come by and take her.
She didn't need a text or his wireless,
nope,
I guess.
Nope.
Your wife, we haven't spoken much about your wife, but she's certainly central to your life and your children. Tell us more about your wife.
She's a teacher. You know,
she is?
Yeah, she's a teacher. She hasn't been teaching because, you know, she's been taking care of the whole family. And mm-hmm. with as busy as I am, it wouldn't make any sense for her to also be out of the house. Keeps everything grounded. Mm-hmm. Keeps me grounded, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Very caring.
She's a good cook?
Oh, excellent cook. And but very wholesome person.
I would think she would be.
Very personal and mm-hmm. fun to be around. You mm-hmm. know, we have a good time. And we've been married for 32 years, so it's...
That's a hallmark in itself.
Indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you were to sum up advice to our listeners, the world, or whomever you wish, based on your experience and your status, your successes, how would you sum up advice for us?
Well, I will say that try your best at everything you do and try to help people out. You know, also, there's good, bad and ugly in every culture and every place. So try to promote the good and try to not do anything that is bad for anybody. Mm-hmm. Work hard, take care of yourself, and enjoy life.
You know, Doctor, I've been doing this show for not a long time, but I've had multitude of guests. And, you know, there's one thing that sticks out with everybody. And that is hard work.
It is.
It doesn't matter what vocation but people that are driven with a sense of purpose, every single one of them has thrown out that ingredient of hard work.
I agree.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And the second thing is spirituality.
Indeed.
A sense of spirituality.
Indeed. A sense of purpose. I'll tell my patients there's two things that will keep them alive longer. Mm-hmm. Work, exercise, and a purpose in life.
I love it. Those are great closing statements. Yes. Dr. Raphael, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For being my guest today.
Appreciate it. Thank you. My pleasure.
You have been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM radio. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support your local community radio? To become a listener supporter, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button or mail a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. You can call 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio or learn more. KKRN is supported by volunteers. And please, if you have interest in learning more about our station, please call or email us. I thank you for listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, where we are in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune in to my shows each first and third Tuesday of each month at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Here you will listen to another triumphant human story. I would love to hear from you, so please send me an email at henry@kkrn.org. Or grab your cell phone and call me directly at 530-356-9811. And I thank you for listening.